In our study tonight, we're continuing in the book of Revelation in the ninth chapter. And if I can do just one thing in our study of the book of Revelation to help us to see some continuity in the book, it is a series of pictures, and I want us to see it as that, but it's not lacking in continuity. It's not like a narrative like Matthew, Mark, and Luke. It's not like any of the other writings in the Bible. It is a writing that contains language that is contingent upon an understanding, obviously, of some Old Testament symbols. And so as the book begins in Revelation chapter 1, we see that these are things, verse 1, that are signified. And we want to take note of that, as we have repeatedly, that these are signs and symbols that are revealed by the angel of the Lord unto his servant John concerning things which must shortly come to pass. Now, the significance of that is for us to see, as we see presented in chapter 1, who the information is from. It is from Jesus, the Christ, the one who holds the keys of death and Hades, verse 18 of chapter 1. And then we begin to read in chapters 2 and 3, the identification of Jesus in all of these epistles, consistent with the description that we saw in chapter 1, and these seven letters written to the seven churches of Asia Minor to typify those things that might exist in any age and in any church. And then in the fourth chapter and fifth chapters, we see the throne room of God. And the grandeur of these two chapters, James, if you're putting together a sermon sometime, that'll preach. James chapters 4 and chapter 5, because we see the greatness of the Almighty God presented in the fourth chapter as we read about the four living creatures and the 24 elders around the throne of God singing day and night in verse 8, holy, holy, holy is the Lord God, the Almighty, who was and who is and who is to come. And then in verse 11, likewise honor being given unto God. And then a sad scenario is presented in the first part of chapter 5, where John sees one holding a book that is sealed with seven seals. Now, John's concern is what's going to happen to the infant church. And in the midst of all of this persecution, and evidently contained within this book, this scroll that's sealed with seven seals, is the answers that John is looking for. But there isn't anyone found to open the book and to loose the seals and to reveal the information that is contained. And then he is told to weep not, because the lion, the tribe of Judah, the root of David, hath overcome to open the book, that's in verse 5, and the seven seals thereof. And then John sees the Lamb standing in the midst of these things. And then we see the four living creatures and the 24 elders falling down before the Lamb and giving worship and honor unto the Lamb. And in verse 9, worthy art thou to take the book and to open the seals thereof. For thou wast slain and didst purchase unto God with thy blood men of every tribe and tongue and people and nation, and madest them to be unto our God a kingdom and priest, and they reign upon the earth. And then, as you see in verse 11, the sound of many, many angels, the voice of 10,000 times 10,000 and thousands of angels singing, worthy is the Lamb to receive the honor and riches and so forth. And then in verse 13, likewise unto him that sitteth on the throne and unto the Lamb be the blessing and the honor and the glory and dominion forever and ever. And all these living creatures fell down and the elders and worshiped. Now then, beginning in the sixth chapter, we see the opening of the seals. And we see with the opening of these seals, the revealing of horses and their riders. And those that would be familiar with Old Testament text would be familiar with the significance of these horses as they are typified or used in the Old Testament and their riders. Now, in the midst of this, you'll note in verse 9, very significant, chapter 6, verse 9, "And when he opened the fifth seal, I saw underneath the altar the souls of them that had been slain for the word of God and for the testimony which they held. And they cried with a great voice, saying, How long, O Master, the holy and true, dost thou not judge and avenge our blood on them that dwell on the earth?" Now, that's very significant because it sets the stage for essentially the rest of the book. These are crying out for justification, for vengeance. And you'll notice that these have been beheaded for the cause of Christ. And so consequently, they're assured that they should rest for a little time, but their cause would indeed be vindicated. Now, in verse 12, we see the opening of the sixth seal. And then at the conclusion of the sixth seal, we see a scene of those saying unto the mountains and the rocks, "Fall on us," verse 16, "and hide us from the face of him that sitteth on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of their wrath is come, and who is able to stand?" Now, we've noted then in chapter 7, that question becomes the springboard into the things that are revealed in chapter 7. So John wants to know, how are the people of God going to stand? So chapter 7 has become what we've called an interlude or a parenthetical series of statements to describe what will happen to God's people during this time of the pouring out of his wrath. And of course, in that chapter, we're introduced then to the 144,000. And then beginning in verse 9, "After these I saw and behold a great multitude, which no man could number, out of every nation and all the tribes and peoples and tongues standing before the throne and before the Lamb, arrayed in white robes and palms in their hands," and so forth and so on. And we want to note that these are they're identified in verse 14 as those who came out of the great tribulation and washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. These are those then who serve the Lord. So this pouring out of God's wrath would not be done until the sealing of those, and we talked about what that might be, sealing for identification, sealing for security. In other words, that those who are called to be saints, that not that they would not be harmed, but they would survive this judgment that would be poured out upon those who became their tormentors. And some of them, of course, would lose it all, but saints as a whole would survive this. The infant church is what I'm trying to say, would not be destroyed. And that's the seventh chapter. Now, beginning the eighth chapter, we saw the opening of the seventh seal. And following that, there was silence in heaven for the space of about a half an hour. Now, we talked about that, and we noted that all of the noise of chapter 4 and chapter 5 of the praise of God who sits on the throne and the Lamb, that now that's turned into silence. God's judgment is about to come forth. And so the question then is, why the silence? And we might picture that as an awesome silence, as we have seen in Old Testament times, where there were periods of silence. We noticed that in Habakkuk chapter 2, when Habakkuk was told that the Babylonian Empire was going to fall down upon the children of Israel, in particular the southern kingdom of Judah, and the city of Jerusalem would be destroyed. And Habakkuk couldn't understand that. And then he said that let all the earth keep silence before God. God is in control. And that's what we want to see here in the book of Revelation. And I don't know how many articles I have read just recently on Facebook and other bulletin articles that to remind us that God is in control. We look round about us and we see things that are alarming. And we don't need to forget, Dan, who we are. We're citizens of God's kingdom, and we're anticipating that heavenly kingdom. And the kingdoms of earth shall pass away, as Bruce led in the song Friday night, but the kingdom of God shall stand. And that's what these in the book of Revelation are being told. You're a part of something that cannot be shaken. And I find it interesting, just so we make a note of this. Sometimes there are those who say, well, no Old Testament prophecy extends beyond the fall of Jerusalem. Now, frankly, I don't believe that's true. I know that there are Old Testament prophecies that pointed to the fall of Jerusalem during the Old Testament times, as we see the Babylonian Empire come upon it. And certainly we can see in the New Testament that there are prophecies regarding the fall of the city of Jerusalem, and we can note that that occurred in AD 70. But now there's an Old Testament passage that is common knowledge to us that I don't want us to forget, and I don't want us to forget an appropriate application of it. You remember when Daniel was talking to King Nebuchadnezzar about the dream that he had? And he explained the dream that King Nebuchadnezzar had, how that it was that he was the head of gold and the arms and chest of silver was representative of the following kingdom. And then the belly and thighs that were of brass, and then the feet that were of iron and were of iron and clay. And we've looked at that in Daniel chapter 2 and noticed a series of kingdoms, starting with that of King Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian kingdom. And Daniel told Nebuchadnezzar, your kingdom is not going to stand. There'll be another one after it. We know that that was the Medes and the Persians as we study both secular history and biblical history. And then we know that the Medes and the Persians, their kingdom would not stand because through Daniel, he told Nebuchadnezzar that there would be another one after him. And this is the intertestamental period we know during the rise of Alexander the Great. The Babylonian Empire fell. And we know that then as we begin the New Testament, we're reading about that fourth empire, the Roman Empire. And let's not forget that Daniel said to Nebuchadnezzar, in the days of these kings, shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom and break in pieces all these, and it shall stand forever. Now, what's he saying even about the Roman Empire? Is it one that would stand forever? Or is Daniel telling King Nebuchadnezzar, including the Roman Empire, it will not stand. The kingdoms of men do not stand. And it's identified as that fourth kingdom by Daniel unto King Nebuchadnezzar. Let's not forget that and the identity of it. Often our approach to passages like Acts chapter 2 and Hebrews chapter 12 are to emphasize the existence of the Roman Empire, that the kingdom of Christ was established during the Roman Empire. But I'm persuaded that Daniel was telling King Nebuchadnezzar that even the Roman Empire, it's not designed to last forever. It too would be destroyed. So there are Old Testament prophecies that point beyond the temporal judgment that God pronounced upon the city of Jerusalem. And the Roman Empire did indeed fall. So the application of some of these things beyond AD 70 is not unreasonable. It's not a reach into the dark in my judgment. But as we look then at the eighth chapter, after this period of silence, we noted another angel came and stood over the altar of incense. And we noticed in that context, he's talking about the prayers of the saints, and the incense was added to the prayers of the saints, and they ascended up unto God. Now, the question is, in verse 5, how did God respond? We noted that there followed thunders and voices and lightnings and an earthquake. And we talked at some length about how that God does indeed respond to the prayers of the saints. We saw the prayers of the saints in Revelation chapter 6, beginning in verse 9. And we see that alluded to again just here. We looked on down through verses 6 through verse 12, and we read about the four angels sounding. And then in verse 13, we noted that the worst is yet to come. For the writer says, woe, woe, woe for them that dwell on the earth by reason of the other voices of the trumpet of the three angels who are yet to sound. So now we've got four, we've got three more. The seven trumpets were indeed to sound. Now that's where we are in our study. And I appreciate you indulging me for a quick review to bring us up to the ninth chapter. Now in the beginning of the ninth chapter, it says, and the fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star from heaven fallen unto the earth, and there was given to him the key of the pit of the abyss. Well, here is a brief outline of the ninth chapter, verses 1 through 12. Hopefully, Lord permitting, or time permitting, we'll have time to talk about the fifth trumpet, the locusts that are in these verses. What we want to note is where they came from, what they were designed to do, how they're described in vivid detail, and who their king is, verses 11 and 12. And so we want to try to talk about those things. Now, as we try to identify the purpose of the sounding of the fifth and the sixth trumpets. Now, Richard, you have these. Donna, you don't. And some of the others maybe who looked at the notes last week don't have this chart. But the main theme is that the transgressor who will not repent brings destruction upon himself as well as he shall feel the wrath of the Almighty God. Now, there are a host of Old Testament passages that teach us that in the book of Proverbs. There are consequences to sin that we commit and refuse to repent of. And so that becomes then the theme that we see in the remainder of this chapter. Should I really envy the prosperity of the wicked? That was a problem that Asaph had, as you recall, in Psalms chapter 73. He looked at those who were of the wicked, and he saw that they prospered, and here he is, one that serves the Lord, and things don't seem to go right for him, and he doesn't understand the why of that until he looked at the latter end, and then he understood. And I think this presents to us somewhat of a picture of that latter end picture that Asaph saw. And then the question, should I fret because it seems like the wicked have the fat of the earth? The obvious answer to that is no. No, we shouldn't be overly concerned about that. Now, in this ninth chapter, verse 1 specifically, and the fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star from heaven fallen unto the earth. And there was given to him the key of the pit of the abyss. And he opened the pit of the abyss, and there went up a smoke out of the pit, as the smoke of a great furnace, and the sun and the air were darkened by reason of the smoke of the pit. And one of the things that I find so dangerous to us is we think that we've got to identify, and I don't know why I have that on there twice. Sometimes we think we just have to identify all of the players, all of the characters with a specific name in world history in order to make these things fit. Because, and you've seen it so many times, even if you talk to a premillennialist, no matter which one you talk to, there's not agreement among the premillennialists in their application of the book of Revelation as to specific kingdoms of men. Some years ago, when I was growing up, well, they had it all worked out. It was Russia and China and a host of other folks that they thought were those who were the oppressors of the church. And we know that some take the approach to the book of Revelation that Russia and China and some of these are going to create some kind of a confederacy of nations. And there's going to be this all out war, the war of Armageddon, and everybody's so scared of being involved in that. And I want to say this just here. Let's be careful when we feel tempted to assign a specific man's name to a specific passage in the book of Revelation. Now, I know that the book of Revelation is prophetic. He's telling them of some things that are to soon come to pass. In that sense, yes, it is prophetic. But the lesson of the book of Revelation is applicable to any age at any time. Now, it certainly had an application to them. But the message may very well have an application to you and to me for us to learn the things that the writer is telling them. No, John is not writing about things that are to take place in 2020. He's telling things that would affect their lives and the lives of their children. Some things that would soon come to pass. But my friend, when the Apostle Paul wrote the book of Philippians, he is writing to a people of that time. Can we read the book of Philippians and learn the lessons of the book? Well, yes, we can. And I think the same principle applies to this. Now, when we look at chapter 9, verse 1, and we read about a star that fell from heaven unto the earth, and there was given to him the key of the abyss. It's not uncommon for us to read in the Bible about stars falling from heaven. In fact, if you'll go back into the 8th chapter and look at verse 10, it says, "And the third angel sounded, and there fell from heaven a great star burning as a torch. And it fell upon the third part of the rivers, upon the fountains of the waters, and the name of the star is called Wormwood." Now, I believe we paused in our study of that passage in our last study, and we talked about some of the understandings that men today have, and they identify this one that was called Wormwood, that was Josephus, the great general of the Jews, the leader of the Jews. And so then when Titus, the Roman general, approached the armies of Josephus, then Josephus surrendered, and so they thought he was dead. However, his army or the citizens thought that he was dead, and then when they found out that he was alive and had surrendered, he was somewhat despised, so his name was Bitterness. Now, I don't know that that's so. I can't be that confident that the man's name is Josephus. I don't know that. And when we look at verse 1 of chapter 9, there are those who think, well, I know exactly who that was, and we can put this man's name on it. No, I'm not sure that you can do that. When Jesus was describing Satan, and some believe that this is the personification of Satan here by this star that fell from heaven, it may or may not be. It might be some particular Roman emperor that was serving as the agent of Satan in persecuting Christians. There would certainly be an application of that. But when Jesus said in Luke 10, verse 18, "I beheld Satan fall as lightning from heaven," I want us to understand that Jesus is not saying that I saw Satan fall from heaven. He said, "I saw Satan fall as lightning from heaven." It might be of interest to you to know that the Bible does not tell us of the origin of Satan. It just doesn't tell us that. Now, I think there are some conclusions that we might come to from a study of certain passages in the Bible, but it does not tell us that Satan has fallen from heaven and that Satan is a fallen angel. It doesn't tell us that. We might surmise that and have some good probability for our understanding of that. But what Jesus is saying in this passage is that Satan and all of his compadres were defeated. And Foy Wallace, who, by the way, takes the early date of the book, he said by his fall from heaven, Jesus meant that Satan would be dethroned from his exalted dominion, and his downfall would come swiftly as lightning in the shaping conflict. Now, I've talked with folks, and you have too, who say, well, he was, in fact, an angel who sinned, and certainly we know that angels had choice. And we can read about the principalities and the powers that Satan had in Ephesians chapter 2, those who obviously followed him. And we know that angels who sinned then have no scheme of redemption. They're held in pits of darkness until the day of judgment. But Foy Wallace is simply describing how Satan fell. It was as swift as lightning come down from heaven. He fell, and there it is. Now, this terminology, we must understand this, is used in Isaiah chapter 14 and verse 12, not to talk about Satan, but rather, I think we pointed this out last time and compared translations, that it's used to talk about the Babylonian ruler. Now, somebody who has in front of you the Old King James translation, if you would please read for me Isaiah chapter 14, verse 12. And then, Randy Childs, if you have before you the New American Standard Translation, if you would read that for me, then that would be helpful. Now, first of all, who is reading from the Old King James Translation? Nobody has that. Richard, could you look that up for me right quick on PC Study Bible?
I've got it. Just a second. I got to find Isaiah. But I read out of that. Yeah. Daphne? And it's 14? Okay.
Isaiah 14, 12.
12. Okay. "How art thou fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? How art thou cut down to the ground, which didst weaken the nations?"
All right, now we isolate that verse and we say, well, there's Satan coming down from heaven. If you go back to chapter 14, verse 1, who's in the context? Who's being discussed? Even in the Old King James translation. Daphne? 14:1. I'm sorry. Isaiah 14:1.
It says, for the Lord will have mercy on Jacob and will yet choose Israel and set them in their own land, and the strangers shall be joined with them, and they shall cleave to the house of Jacob.
Okay, I didn't go back far enough. Go back to 13:1.
Okay. The burden of Babylon, yeah, which Isaiah the son of Amoz did see.
All right, there you are. So now we know who he's talking about. He's talking about the king of Babylon. And if you'll follow that all the way through the 13th chapter, it becomes overwhelmingly so that Isaiah is speaking concerning the fall of Babylon. And who's he called, Daphne, in verse 12 of chapter 14? What's he called, I guess I should say?
14:12 again. Let me see. He's called Lucifer.
He's son called of the Lucifer.
Son of the morning.
Now, that's important for us to note that here he is called Lucifer, but we're discussing the king of Babylon, not the devil. The king of Babylon is called Lucifer. In fact, if you'll go back in this chapter to the 4th verse, he said that thou shalt take up this parable against the king of Babylon. The king of Babylon is referred to as Lucifer. Now, interestingly enough, Richard, if you're reading from the American Standard Translation, Isaiah 14:12, what is he called?
There he's called, O Daystar, son of the morning.
Now, why is the American Standard using the term star or daystar? Well, you see that on the screen. The name Lucifer in the Septuagint translation is translated star. Now, what is the Septuagint translation?
It's the Greek translation of the Old Testament.
It is. Now, the word star represented as falling from heaven, the wicked king's exalted place of dominion. And that's simply how the term is used. The king of Babylon, God raised him up and God brought him down. God raised him up for a purpose. And the book of Habakkuk, the prophet did not understand why them. They're worse than we are. But God said, just as surely as I brought him up, I'll bring him down. I've got a purpose for him. And so he was used. So let's not think that every time we read about a star falling from heaven, that we've got a name attached to it. That's not necessarily true. In the Old Testament text of Isaiah, we know that we're talking about the king of Babylon. But it could just as well be any agent of Satan, or it could be Satan himself.
Did you still want to hear the New American Standard?
Yes, please.
Isaiah 14:12. How have you fallen from heaven, O star of the morning, son of the dawn? You have been cut down to the earth, you who have weakened the nations.
So again, we see in the New American Standard, it follows the language of the American Standard and refers to him as a star. But so we're still talking about the king of Babylon. In that text where Lucifer is used in the old King James, it's not talking about the devil. It's talking about the king of Babylon. Now, is Satan defeated? Well, we noticed a few moments ago that Jesus said, I saw him fall as lightning from heaven, as he suggests the immediacy of his fall. Has Satan been defeated?
Hey, Mickey?
Yes, Bruce?
In the English Standard, it calls him the old day star, son of dawn.
Yeah. Well, the reason that, again, the term star or day star is used is that's the Greek translation of Lucifer, as it were, into the Greek. And that's why we see that in the King James. That's what's followed. More modern translations use the term star, which is correct. Now, in reference to Satan, whether or not Satan has been defeated, I want to look with you at a passage in Hebrews chapter 2, and then we're going to talk about it a little bit. In Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 14, it says, since then, the children are sharers in flesh and blood. He also himself in like manner partook of the same, that through death he might bring to naught him that had the power of death, that is the devil, and might deliver all them who through fear of death were all their lifetime subject to bondage. Two or three things I want us to note in these two verses. Jesus became flesh. Why? Why did Jesus become flesh? It says that he became sharers in flesh and blood. He partook of the same. Why?
Because the wages of sin is death, And he was the only one who could pay that price.
All right. He had to become a man in order to pay that price. You see, the offering of the animals, Hebrews 10, didn't do the job. It necessitated the blood of man, but not just any man. And why not? What kind of man had to die for the sins of the world?
Perfect man.
One that was perfect. Now, think about that. You see, if just any man could die, any one of you could have done that. But the problem is, you see, we're guilty of sin. Jesus was not. He was the only one qualified to make atonement for the sins that we've committed. And that's what you read in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 20 and 21, as well as you see here. He became perfect. Why do you suppose the Apostle John, throughout the Gospel of John, and in 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, and even in Revelation, emphasizes so importantly that Jesus came in the flesh, and that he died, and that now he holds the keys of death in Hades? He was raised from the dead. Why was it so important in John's writing to emphasize that Jesus came in the flesh? You see, if Satan was to be defeated, he could not be defeated with Jesus remaining in heaven. He had to come in the flesh and overcome Satan, tempted in all points like as we are, yet without sin. And he did it. Now, I think the picture that I get in my mind when Jesus was crucified is, as you look at all kinds of Old Testament history and you look at the three promises that God made to make of Abraham a great nation of people, the odds were against that, weren't they? And when you look at God promising unto Abraham a certain land, and when we study about the land of Palestine, we note that it was one of the most, if not the most, fought over piece of real estate in the history of the world. And we can look at its location and determine why. It's a valuable piece of real estate, always has been. Whoever controlled Israel typically controlled the commerce of the world, and in particular the ancient world. So it would seem unlikely that when Abraham came into this land and there were people already living there, that they're just going to say, here, Abraham, take this. No, it took how long for all of that to happen? How long before Abraham's descendants became a great nation? Well, now you know the answer to that as you read in Galatians chapter 3, beginning in verse 16. From the time the promise was made to Abraham until the law of Moses was given, how long was it? Verse 16. Galatians 3, 16 and following.
450 years.
450 years. No, 430 years.
30 years, yeah.
430 years from the time the promise was made to the time that the law was given. And then to whom was the law given? It was given to that great nation of people that you can read about in Exodus chapter 19 and Exodus chapter 20. Specifically 19 verses 5 and 6, they were called a holy nation. Now, just because time passed didn't mean that God was not going to do what he said. It took time, but God was shown to be true in every promise that he made. And now here we are, thousands of years down from the time that God initially spoke to Abraham, thousands of years from the time that God initially spoke to Eve or to the serpent in the Garden of Eden in Genesis chapter 3 and verse 15. And all through that Old Testament history, you can see all kinds of barriers to the fulfillment of God's promise to send his son through the seed of Abraham to provide a blessing to all families of the earth. Can you think of a time when it got down to 1 8-year-old boy that was the only survivor of the seed of David? You don't remember that. Young Josiah, who was protected by the priest. And at the ripe old age of 8 years old, the priest brought him out and declared him to be king. Can you think of another time when it almost was destroyed? All of the Jews were sentenced to death. And who prevented that? You remember when King Artaxerxes was approached by old wicked Haman during the days of the Restoration?
The Book of Esther.
Thank you. The Book of Esther tells us about the plea of Esther to King Artaxerxes, and all the Jews then were spared. Now, can you imagine on at least just those two occasions how jubilant old Satan must have felt? I've got it all upset. I've upset the apple cart. God's plan will never come to pass. And lo and behold, God's plan did come to pass, and Jesus did come to the world just as God had promised, and now he's hung on the cross, as we see indicated here in Hebrews chapter 2. But you see, the problem is he didn't stay dead. God raised him from the dead. And the text tells us in verse 14 that through death he might bring to naught him that had the power of death, that is, the devil. When Jesus was raised from the dead, what did he do to the power of Satan? Wherein lies Satan's power?
You know, Mickey, that verse 15 really steps out, though.
Yes, it does. I want to look at verse 15, but let's look at verse 14 and get the answer to that. And then, Bruce, you can go with verse 15. When Jesus, through death, brought him that had the power of death, that is Satan, he brought him to naught. What does it mean to bring the devil to naught?
To bring him to his knees.
Yes, sir. Brought him to nothing. How did Jesus do that?
Through all power.
Yes, but specifically how?
He destroyed him.
How? Go back and look at chapter 1, verse 18. Revelation 1, verse 18. When Jesus was raised from the dead, what did he do to Satan? Revelation 1, 18.
He has the keys of hell and death.
Isn't that impressive? When Jesus was raised from the dead, now he holds the keys of death and Hades. Oh, wait a minute. What power then did Satan have?
None.
Well, not after Jesus was raised from the dead. His strongest stronghold was brought to naught. That's why Peter said in Acts chapter 2 concerning the Christ that his soul would not be left unto Hades, neither would his flesh see corruption. You see how all this ties together? Here's the victory. When Jesus was raised from the dead, he defeated Satan. Now, we might raise the question, is Satan ultimately defeated at this point? Well, no. We know that Satan's ultimate defeat is going to be at the judgment. But what we want to note here is he no longer has the keys of death and Hades. Who has it?
Jesus
does. All right. Now, that brought to naught the powers of Satan. Now, when you look at verse 15, I'm sorry, Bruce, go ahead with that now. Hebrews 2, verse 15.
Well, in Hebrews 2, verse 15, it all the power and everything, it frees every, let me get there. Because it tells us that Jesus has delivered all the fear, has taken all the fear and everything from death, and he has taken all that for a life of slavery that we were up under.
All right, let me ask you, Bruce, do you have to be afraid to die?
No.
Why not?
Because he has given us a promise.
That's right.
He has given
because
us a
Christ
promise.
Holds the keys of death and Hades. You don't have to be afraid now.
He's given us a promise for eternity.
That's right. He has.
That we may live with him without suffering, without pain, that we may be with him for eternity.
That's right. Now, we know if Christ has defeated Satan in that sense that we're describing in Hebrews chapter 2, does that then mean that any Roman king or any other king, I have to be afraid of what he's going to do to me?
Not at all.
Now, that's what he's telling us, I'm persuaded, in this passage. Now, if you'll note in the text, it says the fifth angel sounded, verse 1, and I saw a star from heaven fallen as unto the earth, and there was given him the key of the pit of the abyss. Now, this is interesting to me. There was given to whoever this is. If it's Satan, then it was given to Satan. If it's Roman king, it was given to him. But this key to this abyss or bottomless pit, note the pit was opened, and smoke like the smoke of a great furnace came forth out of the pit. And the great smoke darkened the sun and the air, the text tells us. This fifth trumpet sounds the warning as all of these, what some have called devilish forces, are unleashed. Now, would that mean perhaps some consequences upon those who were sealed? Well, we're going to talk about that. That's the part of the next part of this chapter. It says they shall torment those who do not have the seal of God on their foreheads. Now, who had the seal? Go back to chapter 7, verse 2. And I saw another angel ascend from sun rising, having the seal of the living God. And he cried with a great voice to the four angels to whom it was given to hurt the earth and the sea, saying, hurt not the earth, neither the sea nor the trees, until we shall have sealed the servants of our God on their foreheads. So those who had the seal, were they harmed by this judgment of chapter 7? No, no. Well, then who would be harmed by this judgment of chapter 7 here in chapter 9? Those who did not have the seal.
Everyone else.
Everybody else. Yeah, everybody else. Now, this punishment would then be unleashed on those who had committed these crimes against God and his people. Those who were the tormentors of God's people, vindication would be gained for God's people against them. Now, the star, a messenger from heaven, perhaps personifying Satan, we're going to talk about that more a little bit later. But what we see is there was given to him the key of the abyss and there were consequences. Some have suggested that this is the abode of demons, that this was preliminary punishment for even the so-called fallen angels and the beasts of chapter 17. We'll talk more about that when we get along to that. But what we do want to note is that Satan is then given control over these forces, whatever they were, and we'll see that in the next little bit of this text. Look now, if you will, back at the text in Revelation chapter 9, verse 3. And out of the smoke came forth locusts upon the earth, and power was given them, as the scorpions of the earth have power. And then in verse 4, and it was said unto them that they should not hurt the grass of the earth, neither any green thing, neither any tree, but only such men as have not the seal of God on their foreheads. And it was given them that they should not kill them, but that they should be tormented 5 months. And their torment was as the torment of a scorpion when it striketh a man. Now, that's real interesting to me, because you've heard of folks that wish they could die and they couldn't. Well, we read about them back over here in chapter 6, verses 15 and 16, during the days of the prophecy of God's judgment that prompted the question, how shall God's people, or who will be able to stand? You see, there were folks then who would say, to the mountains, fall on us, be better to die than to face the wrath of God. And so now we have the releasing of these locusts. And you see in this author's or this artist's mind the depiction of how horrible that was. Now, these locusts were common pests in that day. I would urge you to go online and look at some pictures of what locusts can do. That's just another thing that's incredible to look at. I've seen pictures of that. It looks like a storm cloud coming in. I have on file a picture of a tree that's real lush and green and beautiful. And this swarm of locusts move in, and then just a short time afterward, you see the same tree and it don't even have any bark on it. They've eaten everything in sight. Now, that's what locusts are capable of doing. That's why we see it in Exodus chapter 10 as such a threat upon those people of Egypt, and such destruction that it would reap upon them even after the judgment of hail upon them. Whatever was left, the locust would eat it. There are various illustrations in the Bible that are drawn from this characterization of the locust coming. Joel elaborately spends a good bit of time discussing that. For lack of time, we'll not refer to that. But the locusts were emerging from the bottomless pit that could sting like a scorpion and cause great pain. Now, I find it interesting what happened to the green stuff, the thing that locusts typically eat.
They were ordered not to eat it.
Don't eat that. But then who did they torment? Those who had not the mark of God, the seal of God on their foreheads. Tormented those who then were the tormentors of God's people. Now, we said that it might be a good thing. You can suffer so bad, you just wish you was dead. But these wish they were dead and they couldn't die. They'd just be tormented. And so here come the locusts and power over only those not numbered or sealed with the seal of God. And they were given power as scorpions, the text tells us, upon the earth. Now, I've never been eaten by a scorpion or stung by a scorpion. But I've heard that it's just very, very painful and can make you pretty sick. And I can't begin to imagine the hurt and torment of scorpions just stinging you and stinging you and stinging you, and you wish you could die and you can't. But this is the image. The purpose of these locusts was to torment and hurt, not to kill. The smoke and the darkness would tend to blind men. And so here we see this plague of evil causing men to be blind, I think, to their sins. Now, sin has a vicious sting, and let's not miss this. The vicious sting of sin may not necessarily take your life. It might. For example, you might become a drunkard and that sort of thing, be involved in a car wreck, and wind up killing your fool self, as the expression is. But what we want to note is that sin does have consequences. Those who reap according to the flesh, they reap those consequences, don't they? Paul tells us that in Galatians chapter 6 in verses 7 and 8. The wisdom writer tells us the way of the transgressor is hard. It's interesting to me to talk with people that are ungodly and immoral and then talk to them about the pain of the choices that they've made. They don't like that either. And they think they're having a good time until they begin to reap the consequences of what they've done. Now, this writer is telling us there's consequence to what you do. If we don't get anything else out of this, we've got to get that. There's consequence to what you do. Those who subjected God's people to much torment, they'd receive a whole lot worse. So I'll stop with that and close our study for now. I want to pick up there next time talking about these locusts and how that they would torment, but their torment would not be forever. It would be for a period of time. And then we'll pursue on just a little bit farther in this study. So Revelation chapter 9 still for next time. And before I close, let me extend the Lord's invitation as we always want to do. If somebody has a spiritual need, you understand that you need to obey the gospel. You make that known. We'll do everything that we can do to make that come to pass, baptize you into Christ. But if you have obeyed the gospel and you're not living right and you want brethren to pray for you, don't underestimate the value of prayer. We're willing to help and assist in any way that we can if you'll just make that known to us.